First this morning, I want to go over with you this manuscript release in context of that statement that is so familiar and is used so frequently about the fact that we may have to remain in this here in this world because of insubordination many more years, as did the children of Israel. But for Christ's sake, his people should not add sin to sin by charging God with the consequence of their own wrong course of action. This was a letter to Dr. P.T. McGann at the end of the year 1901. And this letter appears in Manuscript Releases number 20 on pages 310 to 314. As I noted with you or for you yesterday, this letter is in response to a letter received from him from Chicago, and she tells about the circumstances that she finds herself in relationship to the weather. She says it has been bitterly cold. Snow came 2 feet upon the level. Everything frozen up in wash pitchers and bowls, teeth frozen in a solid mass of ice and ink frozen. This was pretty cold. She was up in the New England. And she said that her son, W.C., W. is in Philadelphia attending meetings. He'll be today, we think, in New York City. And then she suggests that it's a pleasant thought that we will meet in Los Angeles. This will be my halting resting spot before returning home. I think that you, as well as I, should have a complete rest. She also includes Dr. Sutherland in this particular letter as far as naming him with P.T. McGann. And now let me read you, starting with the context. Now in regard to the school, and I must assume it must be the opening of the beginning of Loma Linda. I cannot be for sure. Because of the fact they're going to be in Southern California leads me to that conclusion. Now in regard to the school, you seem to think that the plant is to put forth the full bloom lilies, roses, and pinks before the root is fully set deep to do its this grand work. You must begin small and not think that you can show all strength in establishing a school after an advanced order, taking in higher studies. And do not worry about leading teachers or under-teachers before you have sufficient students to warrant the steps you take. Let not human pride hurt your record. Do you not suppose that the Lord sees and acquainted with the favorable and unfavorable presentations? Has not the Lord an oversight over his own word? You may suppose, my brethren, that you have to do all the devising, all the strengthening, and all the organizing. And I ask you, is it not best to show that you have confidence in God? Is it not best to consider that our God is manager, that he is director? You must not be anxious to develop too fast. The hand of providence is holding the machinery. When that hand starts the wheel, then all things will begin to move. Well, now, they started the school at Madison together. Now, I'm just wondering if that's the school now as I read on down through here. Madison began, was it 1904? You remember? I think that's it. So this may be because this is written in 1901. How can finite man carry the burdens of responsibility for this time? God's people have been far behind. Human agencies under the divine planning may recover something of what is lost because the people who had a great light did not have corresponding piety, sanctification, and zeal in working out God's specified plans. They have lost to their own disadvantage what they might have gained to the advancement of the truth if they had carried out the plans and will of God. Man cannot possibly stretch over that gulf that has been made by workers who have not been following the divine leader. We may have to remain here in this world because of insubordination many more years as did the children of Israel. But for Christ's sake, his people should not add sin to sin by charging God with the consequence of their own wrong course of action. Now have men who claim to believe the word of God learned their lesson that obedience is better than sacrifice? He has showed thee, this rebellious people, O man, what is good and what doth the Lord require thee, but to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with thy God. Now the Lord will not be pleased with those men whom he has appointed to a certain work if they, take on many lines of work and carry them until they become so wearisome that it breaks their strength. You, nor any other agency, can heal the hurt that has come to God's people by neglect to lift up his standard and occupy new territory. The churches should now be acting in their strength with capabilities, talents, and means, carrying the work, reaching higher and broader in the capacity to stand before the world in the power of invincible truth. But if all would now only see and confess and repent of their own course of action in departing from the truth of God and following human devising, then the Lord would pardon. And then she goes on, now, my brother, I'm deeply sorry for you and your family, and so forth and so on. Now, what is the rebellion? What is the insubordination? We pull this one statement out, and it's 1888. Well, because it's written in 1901, we pull it out and we say this is organization. What is it? The only cue that I see here is that the individuals that are doing the work do not have a corresponding piety, sanctification, and zeal in working out God's specified plans. She doesn't name them. And then it says here that if all now would only see that and confess and repent of their own course of action in departing from the truth of God and following human devising.
Continue to pray for the leadership or what?
Doesn't say. All is there. She's apparently referring to the workers.
Well, the workers and the leadership.
That's true. Is it specific, the leaders? Is that specifically the leaders? You see what the point? See, the statement has been pulled and used without reference in context as to what it's referring to. I've heard it used in relationship to 1888. I've heard it used in relationship to organization 1901.
It would probably be more reasonable to assume that it's in relation to the organization of 1901 by the date, number one.
All right, but the thing is, then you have a counterstatement that she makes, and for 1901, that there's a most one warm feeling comes over about the situation.
Now, wait a minute, though, because that statement she made at the General Conference session itself, and then you find later statements not long after, to where she talks about that there could have been a revival there, such as not been seen since Pentecost, but that was not to be, and that was right after.
I understand. I put those together for me.
Apparently God was working at the General Conference session, but what had appeared on the part of man to be taking root as far as God's work goes was just a surface thing.
Sure. So how do you use this statement?
Well, like I said, since there is no direct reference actually spelled out within the context right there, all one can do is assume, but it would be a reasonable assumption that it was the 1901 General Conference session she's referring to.
All right, but then you have another factor in this thing. Another factor is this. If this is the Madison School, which is both McGann and Southern who are involved with, because McGann was involved with the one out at Loma Linda, but if this was the Madison School, there were problems in relationship to the South and the work of the South and the support of the thing as far as independent ministries in relationship to the organized work.
Isn't this a little early for that, though?
Well, Madison was ever an independent organization.
No, I mean, isn't the date on this a little early to be talking about Madison School?
Well, what schools are talking about? Because you see, those, they came out of Battle Creek and went to Emmanuel Missionary College. Is it Emmanuel Missionary College?
Yeah.
Then from there, they came down to Madison.
Is it connected with the Loma Linda?
Well,
yeah.
We're going to have to check dates on that, but Loma Linda came soon after that. All I'm interested in right now is that we become aware of all these potential possibilities and that we be very careful how that statement is used and how we use it. And when we see it used, we need to understand a little bit of the background and the context in which it's used.
In other words, we better be careful and say, in speaking of 1888, Mrs. White said.
Yes.
Or in speaking of 1901, she said.
Yes, she didn't, see.
Okay, that's true.
All right, now, as a matter of review, I want to go back and quickly review for you that series of statements that appeared beginning in 1879, the gist of which is, we are now on the very borders of the eternal world. And this was repeated in various ways of saying it. Border of the eternal world, the threshold of the eternal world, the verge of the eternal world, eternity stretches before us. All the emphasis is, this is now the end. And then in connection with this, in the context, the last statement, eternity stretches before us, the curtain is about to be lifted, then this is found on volume 5, page 464. The time is not far distant when, like the early disciples, we shall be forced to seek refuge in desolate and solitary places, as the siege of Jerusalem by the Roman armies was the signal for the flight to the Judean Christians. So the assumption of power on the part of our nation in enforcing, in the decree enforcing the papal Sabbath, will be a warning to us. It will then be time to leave the large cities preparatory to leaving the smaller ones for retired homes and in secluded places among the mountains. Now this was written in 1885. We are 110 years removed from that date. Now perchance, if a Sunday law were enacted by decree, that's what it says here, in a decree enforcing the papal Sabbath, should this be a sign to us to get out into the mountains? Secondly, where would you go? Where would you go?
There's no place you can go anymore.
Well, the foundation, you're already here.
We are in the mountains. I mean, the Ozark Mountains, but I mean, in 15 years that we've been here, more than 15 years, right? In more than 15 years that we've been here, you become automatically conscious that this is no longer an isolated place.
That's right, yeah.
All you have to do is drive out of Clarksville up here, and you notice 15 years ago and now, entirely different. Different. Populated. If our foresight had been such that it corresponded with the admonition, "Occupy till I come," and we had believed, or no, wait a minute, believed, if we had assumed that time would have gone on this long, you know what we should have done? We should have controlled all the land from the end of that road right on up here, so that there was only one group right down in here. We didn't do it, because we felt we won't be here that long.
Yeah, but even in its original context, today that wouldn't have done you any good in that original context, because she's talking in a time to where, you know, the land was basically woolly, wild, and free. Mm-hmm. Even if you controlled it, you know, that control's going to run out when you can't buy and sell, you know.
Can you hide today from the authorities that want to get you?
No.
What do they have? Infrared.
Satellite surveillance.
Yeah. There's constant surveillance by the ATF and everything, black helicopters, all this stuff.
It's hard for us to imagine on how sophisticated satellite surveillance is.
All right.
The other thing is that if you went and bought all that property, all it takes nowadays is somebody to say that they think that you're selling drugs or whatever, and then come up here and take your land. There's no proof.
That was my point. I mean, to own it now wouldn't mean anything in this context.
We have had the choppers flying over us, watching, because some neighbor had come down and planted marijuana on our property. And the thing is, when I finally called the sheriff, I was notified to call the sheriff. When I called the sheriff, he says, "Don't worry, we know who's doing it. We know that you're okay," and so forth. We have men out there now, and they were in the bushes around here. I hadn't seen them, ready to pounce on the individual that had come over the line and was selling, had planted the marijuana. Where are you going to go? The point that I'm trying to make is not a derogatory aspect of the council.
Right.
The point is that we are 110 years removed, and it is not relative at this present time, and we need to understand it in that light. Does that make her a false prophet?
No.
Was Jonah a false prophet?
No.
You see, we come back to that fundamental principle, but we have to use our God-given intelligence as to where we are and what we are.
Well, even all the answers you got right here shows that. I mean, there's nothing derogatory about the council. It's just simply the time we live in.
But you see, there are certain individuals now in the independent movements that will not accept that fact. And you'll have the Sunday law track going all over the place, this and that and something else.
Well, it should be observed from that statement that you read that while it doesn't specifically say national Sunday law, that's what it would have been.
Right, but it's talking about it by decree.
Of this land.
Yes, this land.
Yeah, see, that would have been a national Sunday law.
But there's no such language in the
no.
All right, now another thing. Is there any hope? Yes. The book of Daniel was sealed to when? The time of the end. In the stories that are found in the book, was there an image?
Yes.
And did those individuals that had to face that image find a wilderness?
No.
Did they go into the smoking furnace, the fiery furnace?
Yes.
Who went with them?
Jesus.
Is it telling us that in the last hour, no matter what the circumstances may be, if we stand for truth, even though we cannot hide, there will be one with us?
Amen. Yeah, amen.
And that is our only hope.
Right. All right. Secondly, was there a decree made that regulated worship?
Yes.
To whom?
Yeah. To Jehovah.
Well, limited to the worship of the king.
Yeah, okay, right, yeah.
And who was involved? Did he run and hide?
No.
What did he do?
He prayed right out to the same
Wait a minute. He put his blinds up. He put him up.
As his manner was.
He did not try to hide.
Nope.
But who was sent to protect him?
The angel
closed the lion's mouth. That book with those experiences is sealed to the time of the end. And it's my conviction that those stories are just as important to us as the prophecies. And in those stories we can gather faith and hope against the day in which we're living, which is way beyond the map that Adventism has been developing. And we dare not forget that fact. And so we can have hope and courage as far as the thing is concerned. And as we know, was there some clarification question?
I was going to say, look at the children of Israel in the desert for 40 years. They didn't have to worry about their food, their clothing, their water, anything. The Lord took solely care of them.
True, and the Egyptians didn't come out after them because they were pretty well in the wilderness.
But even at that, they didn't have everything to sustain them for 40 years.
I know, I understand that factor, but I mean, they got out in the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that wilderness was so bad that when the Jewish state was offered that in a construction, they found it was so arid they couldn't even take that offer. So it was pretty bad out there. God had to take care of them because there's no other way to take care of this folk out there. All right, now, I want you to notice another thing about this particular period. In other words, this period, remember these statements that I've read you from Volume 5, that the end is upon us, are all in the section of this, is in the format of this period. Time and place.
Amen.
This is the thing it's in. And the Sunday law that was spoken of, of course they use the term National Sunday Law, which is an invented term, and so forth and so on, it actually came about. A law was enacted. And in the light of that, The suggestion was made that this is the loud cry, which would mean that Revelation 17 had been fulfilled and we were down as far as the 18th chapter. But this is not the truth. It's not the facts of what actually happened. But something else was there that could have happened that we need to definitely understand. And I want you to follow through on this chart that I'll have passed out at this time. first look, holding it this way, look at the secular history line at the bottom, holding it up like this, the bottom, the secular history line. We're going to note certain factors from 1869 and 71. The Vatican Council won and the Kingdom of Italy. In other words, we're talking a lot about the Vatican II, but we need to understand Vatican I a little bit also. All right, then 1888 was the National Sunday Rest Bill introduced. It did not pass. In 1892, there was a Sunday law, and I've used the common term, National Sunday Law. It was made a rider to the Columbia Exposition Financial Enactment, based on the fact that they would close the Columbian Exposition. See, 1492, 1892, we're going to close that on Sundays. And they were allowed an appropriation. It was a tied to appropriation bill. And then interestingly, which is little understood and known, in 1896 and 1897, there was a Jewish state proposed. The First Zionist Congress. In other words, this matter of Jerusalem and Israel is not something old, something new. It's something that is tied in with each end expectancy situation. All right, now on the timeline above, you have the Seventh-day Adventist Church history. You'll recognize the dates, 44, 78, 88, 892, 901, 02, 03, 05. Now what is interesting is that during this period of time, this last decade of the 19th century, 99% of every major statement that has to do with the Sabbath Sunday question came to the fore. And we who have spent many years in evangelism, as we discussed in evangelistic messages, the change of the Sabbath drew on the source documentation of the last decade of the 19th century. Now I want you to notice these particular statements. In 1889, yes, here it is, in the Industrial American, this is, by the way, this is on page 289 of the book Facts of Faith. If you don't have the book Facts of Faith, you better plan to get one. There's a lot of documentation in here. On page 289 of Facts of Faith is this quotation from the Industrial American, published in Harlan, Iowa, December 19, 1889. Here's what Father Enright wrote. The Bible says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. But the Catholic Church says, no, keep the first day of the week, and the whole world bows in obedience. That was in 1889. Well, now, what had God planned in the message of 1888? A message that was to finish the work. And now here's these arguments already starting to appear from the Catholic source telling us exactly what they where they stood. Did you have to do a lot of proving? Quote. That's all you had to do is quote from them. God was planning the way before at this particular point of time, and we dare not overlook that fact. Now, in 1893, and in order to, in getting these statements out, I just went to my notebook that I keep kind of in reserve now, but this notebook is full of the quotations and documentations that I use in evangelism on the matter of the Sabbath presentation. I have these documents still just held, and so among those documents, I have a copy, a notarized copy of a letter that tells about this statement that Dr. E.T. Hiscox, author of the Baptist Manual, at a Baptist minister's meeting held, what he said, and you're going to find it very familiar. He says there, of course, I quite well know that Sunday did come into use in early Christian history as a religious day, as we learn from the Christian fathers and other sources. But what a pity that it comes branded with the mark of paganism and christened with the name of the sun god, then adopted and sanctified by the papal apostasy and bequeathed as a sacred legacy to Protestantism and the Christian world, just as Easter and so forth. A very familiar statement. A very positive statement. When? 1893. Then we find that also in relationship to in 1893, that an individual wrote a letter to, let me see where that is. Yes. Wrote a letter to Cardinal Gibbons, which was, who was the outstanding cardinal in America at the time. J.F. Snyder of Bloomington, Illinois, wrote Cardinal Gibbons asking if the Catholic Church facts of faith. The cardinal, through his chancellor, gave the following answer. Of course the Catholic Church claims that the change was her act. It could not have been otherwise, as none in those days could have dreamed of doing anything in matters spiritual, ecclesiastical, and religious without her. And the act is a mark of her ecclesiastical power and authority in religious matters. 1895. Now mark this. We have preached the mark of the beast as Sunday observance. We have preached it on the basis of this statement. The Catholic Church claims that this is the mark of her authority and power. This is the only document reference that we have. Now keep this in mind. This is in the last decade of the 19th century. Now I'm going to ask you a question for you to think about, and we'll answer in due course. Is this what they say is the seal now? Is this what they say is the mark now? Now hold that and watch for the answer. 100 years later, 1895. Then you find that the Catholic World, a magazine in 1894, said this in an article that appeared. This is a monthly magazine of general literature and science of the Catholic world. And this is on the Pascale Gaudium. And this is what it says. The Church took the pagan philosophy and made it the buckler of faith against the heathen. She took the pagan Roman pantheon, temple of all the gods, and made it sacred to all the martyrs. And so it stands to this day. She took the pagan Sunday and made it the Christian Sunday. She took the pagan Easter and made it the feast we celebrate during the season. Then it goes on to say that the sun was a foremost god in heathendom. Hence the Church in these countries would seem to have said, keep that old pagan name. It will remain consecrated, sanctified, and thus the pagan Sunday dedicated to Balder became the Christian Sunday sacred to Jesus. How much more do you want to give the facts? We use this in evangelism. But where was these documents from? Where were these statements from? The last decade of the 19th century. What was God trying to do with his church and people? What was he doing in the world? What were the other things that were set up? We need to note. And I think we can then understand that God had plans and something didn't go right. And naturally then you see we've called up that statement about insubordination because you see you have those facts and she's talking about truths. There's quite a picture. All right, then we go on further. It's 1895 that this mark of Catholic authority that we have here Sunday. And then in 1997, we have the end of religious controversy, a tract that was reprinted from a previous decade. And then starting in 1899, were a series of offers made by Father Enright. And I have a photocopy of his original little note that he wrote. He says here, in June 6, 1899, I hereby offer $1,000 to anyone who can prove to me from the Bible alone that I am bound under pain of grievous sin to keep Sunday holy. Written from Kansas City, Missouri. 1899. Then we find that a few years later, in 1902, when he transferred to Detroit, Michigan, he says, your note was forwarded to me here where I now reside at present. I have never seen Mr. Gamble. Mr. Gamble said that Father Enright withdrew his offer. The assertion that I have withdrawn the offer is utterly false. I still offer $1,000 to anyone who can prove to me from the Bible alone that I am bound under pain of grievous sin to keep Sunday holy. We keep Sunday in obedience to the law of the Catholic Church. The church made this law after the Bible was written, and hence the law cannot be found in the Bible. The Catholic Church abolished not only the Sabbath, but all the other Jewish festivals. Then, in 1905, when he transferred to the Church of Self Saint in St. Louis, I guess it was in St. Louis, no, Detroit, he went to St. Louis, he said, "I have offered and still offer $1,000 to anyone who can prove to me from the Bible alone that I am bound to a grievous sin to keep Sunday holy." It was the Catholic Church which made the law obliging us to keep Sunday holy. The church made this law long after the Bible was written, hence the said law is not in the Bible. How much more do you need? How much more do you want? Where did this all come from? The last decade of the 19th century. Now, let's look at some other things. Let's look at this secular history line as far as the papacy is concerned that you have here in the thing, and I'll give you some references on that. In 1869, 1871, what actually happened? Not only do you have an action of the Vatican II, Vatican I Council, but you also have some political movements over there in Italy. Italy became a kingdom. And becoming a kingdom, it took the papal states. In other words, it reduced the papacy to having no land. It ceased to be a state. But notice what the government did. And I'm reading now from the Encyclopedia Britannica, the 1958 edition, volume 12. It says here that on September 20th, 1870, General Rafael Cadorna forced a breach in the port of Pia, and after a token resistance, Pius IX accepted what he had not the force to withstand. A plebiscite was held in October, which, as usual, gave an overwhelming majority for union with Italy. In other words, all the states that the Pope owned disappeared. First in importance was now the problem of trying to reconcile the Vatican to the loss of temporal power and to the existence of a secular and even anti-clerical government in the Holy City itself. Now, keep in mind that in 1798, the government of the papacy was declared at an end. In 1871, they then passed what they hoped to be the generous law of guarantees to regulate the position juridically, so far as possible, implementing Cavour's doctrine of a free church and a free state. The Pope's position was to be sacred and his person inviolable. While free discussion was allowed on religious matters, insults and outrages against the Catholic faith were punishable. The Pope was allowed ownership of the Vatican and Lateran palaces and promised an annuity of more than 3 million lire. That's the official Italian coin. He was to have diplomatic immunity for foreign representatives attached to his court. The state gave up its old jurisdictionless rights over the church, and bishops no longer had to swear fealty to the king. Pius would not accept this and claimed that he was a prisoner of the Vatican. That was in 1870, 71. That's your first picture. But what happened at Vatican I? In the Encyclopedia Britannica, volume 23 of the 1858 edition, it says this: the resolutions of the Vatican Council, that's Vatican I, entirely revolutionized the position of the Pope within the Church. He is first accredited with complete and supreme jurisdictional authority over the whole Church, not simply in matters of faith and morality, but also in matters touching the discipline and governance of the Church. And this authority is regular and immediate, is a regular and immediate authority extending over each and every church and over each and every pastor and believer. The Pope was the supreme head declared by Vatican I over every individual down to the very member, single member of the Catholic Church. Again, the dogma implies a fundamental change in the position of ecumenical councils, which in conjunction with the papacy had till then been supposed to be to constitute the representation of the Roman Catholic Church. The Pope was head of the councils. Instead of presiding over the councils, his authority was supreme. And yet he was a prisoner of the Vatican. Now, we come to some more very, very interesting things.
Was that statement in 1913?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, what about Zionism? Let's take a look at that picture at that time. In 1896, a new chapter opened with the publication of a pamphlet entitled Der Judenstaat, a Jewish State, by Theodor Herzl. In it, he elaborated a scheme for the reestablishment of an autonomous Jewish state somewhere in the world. I noticed when he started out, it was going to be somewhere in the world. He found popular support throughout Europe for a Jewish commonwealth in Palestine, and in 1897 convened the first Zionist International Congress in Basel, Switzerland, which was attended by 204 delegates. The Congress established the Zionist organization for the purpose of giving effect to the following program. They were going to build up the thing in Palestine as the summary of it. In 1901 and again in 1902, Herzl had audiences with the Sultan, but the negotiations led to nothing. He now sought from the British government a grant of territory on an autonomous basis in the vicinity of the Holy Land, which would provisionally afford a refuge and a political training ground for persecuted Jews. Part of the Sinai Peninsula was surveyed, but became, because of the waterless character of the country, the project was given up. The children of Israel wandered 40 years there. Then Joseph Chamberlain suggested the uninhabited highlands of East African Protectorate, and in 1903, the British government made the Zionist organization a provisional offer of an area of 6,000 square miles in the Negushu Plateau. This offer was warmly appreciated as a mark of British goodwill, but because of divisions in the Zionist organization, that was given up. And so finally, they settled on the matter of Palestine and worked to that end. Now, let me ask you a question. I'll put it in a form of a fact and then a question. We're told that the final movements would be rapid ones, right?
Mm-hmm.
If the circumstances had followed through, the Sabbath question was there agitated. Everything was ready for a loud cry for a finishing of the work. The papacy was there and was involved. We're going to notice how much further. Would it have taken long to set up a Jewish state and bring about the fulfillment of that prophecy?
No.
No.
Everything was delayed mysteriously at that time. Delayed.
I can't document this. I've been looking, but an Adventist brother a while back said that in the Green Books, the Advent Review and Sabbath Herald books, that there was an article in there, not an E.G. White article, but from Rama's time period, an article in there by one of the brethren that dealt with a newspaper article that he had read that the Zionist movement had gathered themselves up an army and they were going to go over into the Palestine and, if necessary, take by force some land over there to establish the Jewish state, and it fell apart.
At that particular time.
I haven't been able to document that. I've been looking for it, but I was told that.
All right. Now, let's go back and look at this period for just a little bit from a little different angle. A little recognized factor in this last decade of the 19th century is the fact that Leo XIII occupied the papal chair. He occupied the papal chair from 1878 to 1903. He spanned that whole decade. Now, he, during this period, issued several memorable encyclicals. In fact, you'll find that these encyclicals are listed as the great, in a book, are listed as the great encyclical letters of Leo XIII. Now, in the first one, in 1885, that he issued, this is what he has to say, and listen carefully. This is from Facts of Faith, page 256. The Christian Constitution of States, he outlines such a position as stating that the state should profess the Catholic religion and that the Roman pontiffs should have the power of making laws. Now, Leo XIII, in his great encyclical letter, Immortal God, Immortal Day, said this, and assuredly, All ought to hold that it was not without a singular disposition of God's providence that this power of the church was provided with its civil sovereignty as the surest safeguard of her independence. He says of the Middle Ages, then the church and state were happily united. Sad it is to call to mind how the harmful and lamentable rage for innovations which arose to a climax in the 16th century spread amongst all classes of society. From this source and from as from a fountainhead burst forth all these later tenets of unbridled license. Amongst these principles, the main one lays down that as all men are alike in race and nature, that each is free to think on every subject just as he may choose. In a society grounded upon such maxims, all government is nothing more or less than the will of the people. All right. Now we're going to run into Leo the Thirteenth again, but keep this in mind. This is one of his encyclicals. Then in a letter, which became an encyclical in January 6, 1895, and this was called Liberalis, it would be very erroneous to draw the conclusion that in America is to be sought the type of the most desirable status of the church, or that it would be universally lawful or expedient for state and church to be as in America, dissevered and divorced. She would bring forth more abundant fruits if, in addition to liberty, she enjoyed the favor of the laws and the patronage of the public authority. But also declared, in his great encyclical letters, we hold upon this earth the place of Almighty God. He also said, but the supreme teacher of the church is the Roman Pontiff. Union of minds therefore requires, together with a perfect accord and the one faith, complete submission and obedience of the will to the church and the Roman Pontiff as to God himself. This Leo the 13th. And remember, he's the product of Vatican I. We're talking about the end timeline and what we're going to face, but we have to lay the foundation in the last decade of that century. It was this concept of what they hold on this earth as the place of Almighty God, which forms the basis of a statement that was found in the Catholic National, July 1895. The Pope is not only the representative of Christ, but he is Jesus Christ himself hidden under a veil of flesh. This is plain blasphemy. But it's telling you something of how they perceive of themselves. And if any of you have had a chance to look at this book, this is the Pope's book, His Holiness John Paul II, Crossing the Threshold of Hope. If you read the first chapter carefully, you're going to find that John Paul II believes this about himself. He believes this also about himself. We're not dealing with just little things. We're dealing with some of the majors of what we're going to face in the end. Now there are other encyclicals of Leo the 13th. I'm going to just name them for you. In 1891, he issues what is called Rerum Novarum, which expounds the Roman Catholic social gospel. And then in 1894, he issued another encyclical in which he attempted to heal the schism of 1054. He was working toward a unity, an ecumenism. Then in 1899, in a letter to Cardinal Gibbons of Baltimore, he declared against Americanism. The American way was not the way. Now we come to the first half of the 20th century, and we're going to take a break. Before proceeding into the first half of the 20th century, I want to summarize that last decade. If you'll notice the board, you'll find there that as far as the last decade of the 20th century, it was marked by clear, concise acknowledgments of the Sabbath controversy, the Sabbath Sunday issue. Furthermore, there was introduced into the picture the issue of church and state, which are all vital factors in the prophecy of what is to come and the issues that are to be involved. Now, as we enter the first half of the 20th century, traditionally, we note 1929 as a key date. 1929 as a key date. It was at that time that Mussolini, dictator in Italy, and Gasparri of the Vatican signed what is called a historic Roman pact. And so it was noted in the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, February 12th, 1929. And interestingly, in this San Francisco Chronicle, they had a subtitle, Heal Wound of Many Years, which were the words of prophecy. And so we latched on to this concept of 1929 as the healing of the deadly wound. But I think we need to understand, and we will see as we study, that the healing of the deadly wound has been a progressive thing. And under those circumstances, I think we can safely say that as of now, the wound has been healed. And so with that in the background, let's go forward just a little further. We find also here in the first half of the 20th century that the ecumenical movement was born. Before World War II, there were two ecumenical councils. One was Life and Work, and the other was Faith and Order. And these two councils wanted to form a joint organization, and those two councils in collaboration recommended a World Council of Churches. Now, what is very, very interesting in regard to these World Council of Churches is the fact that there has been a chart put out, I have it here, that tells about the two councils at Edinburgh and at Oxford, one in Scotland and one in England. And one was the Life and Work, and the other was Faith and Order. And in this list of organizations that came and were involved in these councils to bring about the World Council of Churches, is the name Seventh-day Adventists. It's clearly written in here. And what we sometimes do not know, and that we do not realize, is that when these two councils were operating, one in Edinburgh and one in Oxford, for the purpose of getting together, the Secretary of the General Conference wrote to the Northern European Division and said for them, if at all possible, make provision for us to have delegates there. And I have some of their letters, of the correspondence that went on as far as the thing is concerned. And we find that on June 18, 1937, just before, as the war was breaking out, the Secretary of the Northern European Division wrote to E.D. Dick, on the 25th of April, you wrote me suggesting that the Northern European Division appoint delegates to the World Conference on Faith and Order, which is to be held in Edinburgh in August. I have taken up correspondence with the secretary of this conference in Britain, and we have been given permission to appoint two delegates, namely W. E. Reed and H. W. Lowe, who expect to be there. I don't get any reaction from you. Does anybody know who W. E. Reed is?
Yes. He's on the Evangelical Conference.
He was the one who was involved also with the brother in the SD Evangelical Conferences. And Lowe was longtime head of the Sabbath School Department of the General Conference. All right, at the very beginning, high men were involved. There's another World Conference to be held at Oxford this year on church, community, and state. We endeavored also to get opportunity of appointing delegates to this conference, but we were informed a few days ago that some 18 months ago, all church organizations who were to be represented at this conference were notified, and that they cannot now at this late date give us any delegation. It seemed that the Seventh-day Adventist Church was not listed among the churches which were to be represented. Brother Lowe is hoping, however, to get an opportunity to attend it, as without doubt the relationship between the church and state will be taken up quite fully. With kind regards, very sincerely yours, J.I. Robinson. So, this was the organization. The World Council of Churches did not begin to function until after World War II. So after World War II, those that made up the official list of the World Council of Churches wrote to J.I. Robinson, and this was W.A. Visser to Hooft. He says, I have been instructed to forward to you the enclosed official invitation, which has been duly signed by the following members of the Committee of 14, and that was to become a part of the World Council of Churches, which was to be formed, which was to function in 1948. So after urging representation at these conferences, it formed it. On March 30th, 1939, the General Conference issued the following statement. An inquiry was received from the Northern European Division with reference to our accepting invitation to membership in the World Council of Churches that is in process of formation. It was voted to reply to this inquiry that in harmony with our denominational position concerning such matters, we do not consider it advisable to accept membership in this organization. Wanting to get in, and then the pressure came on, and we back out. Policy. Nevertheless, the World Council of Churches was formed in 1948, and then in 1950, the National Council of Churches came into existence in America. And we decided we'd do a little backdoor work. In 1960, a letter signed by the Assistant General Secretary of the National Council of Churches stated the Seventh-day Adventist Church does hold voting membership in several of our program units, and in addition has non-voting or associate membership in other units. In 1959, the General Conference of Seventh-day Adventists set a total of $6,700 toward the support of these program units to which it has one relationship or another. So we got into the National Council picture. And so then finally, through the World Faith and Order Commission of the World Council of Churches, we have involved further, which we'll note in a little bit. Another thing happened in 1948. Israel became a state. Now, in this picture of Israel becoming a state, we have a lesson in prophetic interpretation to learn. In 1947, there was issued by the Pacific Press a book by Roy F. Cottrell, The Jews in Palestine. And in this book, now this is in 1947, 1 year before 1948, Cottrell wrote, in the impressive drama of the prophet and the potter's earthen vessel, the word of the Lord instructed Jeremiah, Then shalt thou break the bottle in the sight of men that go with thee, and thou shalt say to them, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, Even so will I break this people in this city, as one breaketh a potter's vessel that cannot be made whole again. The God of heaven who overthrow the city and nation, who because of their apostasy dispersed the inhabitants to the ends of the earth, forever settles the question of a complete return and restitution in old Canaan, by asserting that it cannot be. And within 1 year, it was. What should that do as far as our own interpretation of prophecy is concerned? We should walk humbly on our knees in our understanding of prophecy.
We better not make dogma out of it.
Right. We better be very, very careful. We said Israel will never be a state, and within 1 year it was. Then, prior to that, in 1944, the Voice of Prophecy used as a gift of a monk book, Palestine Prophecy, written by J.C. Stevens. And in this book, his last paragraph was, the Apostle Paul speaks of old Jerusalem as being in bondage with her children. Had the Jews been faithful, Jerusalem would have been enlarged and beautified to become the center of the whole earth. Beautiful for situation. But throughout the generations, the fall of that city in A.D. 70, Jerusalem has been a burdensome stone and a cup of trembling unto all people. And it will be so to the end of time. Palestine and Jerusalem do not have a bright future in this present world, and those who are holding the hope of a national restoration for the Jews are following a theological will-o-wisp. What are the facts? These are official publications even used by the Voice of Prophecy. This should cause us to take a very careful look at things. Now then, once the state was established, then we had to face something else. And that was faced at the 1952 Bible Conference. Arthur Maxwell, I'm going over ground that's familiar to all of you, I'm sure. Arthur Maxwell was given a paper to read, or was given an assignment to read a paper at the 1952 Bible Conference on the imminence of Christ's second coming. And in this paper, he listed three areas of unfulfilled prophecy. And in volume two of Our Firm Foundation, which is one of the two volumes on this conference, he lists there on page 230, among the unfulfilled Bible prophecies, developments in Palestine. Now keep in mind, he was writing and presenting this in 1952, just 4 years after Israel became a state. This is what he says. The recent dramatic restoration of the nation of Israel has focused the attention of mankind once more upon Palestine. However, there is one prophecy concerning Palestine that we should all be watching with special care. Said Jesus, Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles and the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Luke 21:24. Now mind you, he said this in the Sligo Park Church in which the conference was held to ministers and administrators gathered from all parts of the world field. I happened to be there. This was said to the leadership, the clerical leadership of the church. This prophecy was called to their attention. This fact dare not be overlooked. Now what does he say about it? For 19 centuries, Jerusalem has been trodden down of the Gentiles. It is still trodden down of the Gentiles. Despite the amazing prowess of the Israeli troops, the ancient city of Jerusalem is still in Arab hands. This is 1952. A Mohammedan mosque still stands upon the site of Solomon's temple. Victorious as were the forces of Israel in every other part of Palestine, they failed to take the most dazzling objective of all. Mysteriously, they were held back from achieving this most cherished goal, this culminating triumph, by an unseen hand. What could be the reason? Only that the times of the Gentiles are not yet fulfilled. He said that in 1952. Centuries ago, Israel was not permitted to enter Palestine for a certain time because the iniquity of the Amorites was not yet full. See, how is he comparing the term time to the Gentiles? With the iniquity of the Amorites, their probationary time. They were not ignorant of what they were dealing with. That is, not until the probationary time allotted to the Amorites had run out. They nailed it down as to what this term meant. It may well be that the same principle applies today on a wider scale. If so, then, Jerusalem is to remain trodden down by Gentiles till the probationary time of all Gentiles has run out. If this be correct, how much hinges upon the fate of this ancient city and the power that occupies it? These are words to the delegates at the 1952 Bible Conference, and they're stating the facts straight. Telling us that when Jerusalem would be liberated, the probationary time of the nations would be over. Then when it happened, 1967, what have they been taking? They've been backpedaling so fast that the water flows in a different direction. Absolutely. It's tragic what happens. Here they face the facts and state them as they are, and then when they occur, it can't be true. What do you say? What can you say? You wonder what to say. How can you wake them up? When they admit it, on the basis of their own admission, 1967 and the connection of the Akriu, which brings it to 1980, indicates that as far as the corporate bodies of earth are concerned, they passed the probationary line. Now it's interesting that in our history we have had some comments about it, and it's interesting how they've been waffled on. James Edson White wrote The Coming King. In 1898, it was published by the Pacific Press Publishing Company. And here in this volume, James Edson White says this: "We also read that Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles, and the times of the Gentiles will be fulfilled. Jerusalem has never come under the possession of the Jews, and will not until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. This will be when the work of the gospel is finished." How much clearer could he state it? This is what was stated in a position published Pacific Press. And after all, I don't read anywhere where Sister White condemned this book. This is her son. But interestingly, when it got to Australia, they rewrote some of this. And in the Australian division, as Australian edition, published in Melbourne, some of you know where Melbourne is, the Echo Publishing Company, it's given here as North Fitzroy, Victoria, Australia, it says we, what?
Fitzroy.
Thank you. We also read that Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles, and the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Jerusalem has never again come under the possession of the Jews, but when the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled, and Christ comes to gather the faithful of all ages, then all who are Israelites indeed, all the household of faith, will have a home in that city of which old Jerusalem was but a type, the city for which Abraham looked, whose builder and maker is God. The Australians got it all worked out so it smoothed the whole problem over. But I imagine it was Americans as missionaries to Australia. All right, and in 1906, again, The Coming King was published. And this was by the Review and Herald Publishing Association. This got a little closer to headquarters. And it says this: "We also read that Jerusalem shall be trodden down the Gentiles, and the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled." Luke 21:24. "This will be when the work of the gospel is finished." And nothing more is said or elaborated on. So this gives us a little background in the history of this doctrine and the teaching and how it has been presented in the church. I might make mention of the fact that there is now a publication that I received a copy of just this past week entitled Armageddon. One chapter which deals with the time of the Gentiles, and another chapter which deals with Hiram Edson's article on it that was written way back at 1856 or somewhere there. And the gist of this whole thing in this particular publication that's now come out is that actually the time of the Gentiles was up, and I think I have it from a brief survey of it, in 1798. The 1260 days equals that, and so forth and so on, which was happened to be a Brimsmead position when Brimsmead was in the heyday of his power, or his day of his popularity. But the question is this: what is this prophecy actually saying? The roots of which was in the first half of the 20th century, 1948, when the Jewish state was formed. It's telling us that God is giving us a sign, specifically letting us know when corporate bodies have completed their probation. The Bible speaks of corporate bodies both as political entities and religious entities. You have in Isaiah, the righteous nation which keepeth the truth may enter in. A religious entity is a nation. You have also in the New Testament the expression the commonwealth of Israel. A political expression involves a religious entity. And then into this picture must be brought the sanctuary question, even as they brought the sanctuary question into the picture of 1844. The sanctuary is the key that unlocks our problems. And we need to recognize that fact. And this is why the enemy is so intent that we are robbed of our understanding of the sanctuary.
Amen.
And this is why we need to study it very carefully. Not just the symbolism of structure. Be it far from us to emphasize that. Although it has meaning and hope. And can give us inspiration. The services that they served unto an example and shadow of heavenly things. Now we come to another event in the first half of the 20th century, Fatima. And this event has been long overlooked. First, I want to give you the events connected with that particular experience. On May 13, 1970. And if you have the book, The Fatima Factor in the Final Hours, then you're going to be able to follow through because it's well outlined here. And I'm going to give you not only what's in here, but also in The Keys of This Blood by Malachi Martin. And of necessity, I'm going to read very closely on this particular point, but I think you'll find it most interesting as far as the thing is concerned. Again, if you do not have the book, I would suggest that you get it, not because we are distributing it, but because of the material that's in it for your own information.
What's the title again?
It's The Fatima Factor in the Final Hours. The Fatima Phenomenon, this is on page 132, is an event which took place on May 13, 1917 over a peaceful grazing pasture near the village of Agestro, Portugal, 45 kilometers north of Lisbon. On that day, three peasant children, Lucia and her two cousins, Francisco and Jacinta, were quietly tending their sheep when they suddenly noticed the mysterious appearance of an enormous ghostly lady in the sky who identified herself as the Lady of the Rosary, Mary, the Mother of Jesus, and entrusted them with a number of messages. When the strange visitation ended, the excited children relayed their experience to the villagers. They said that they had been told to meet Mary on the 13th day of each month thereafter. The news of the vision sped quickly throughout Portugal, Europe, and Latin America, and vast crowds gathered at the place on the 13th of each following month to witness repeats of the original event. The June 13 repeat of the heavenly messenger, in quotes, was accompanied by a warning of the approaching death of two of the children. I will take Francisco and Jacinta soon, the apparition sternly prophesied. We don't know the effect of this warning had on the youthful visionaries, but the uncertainty about a continuation of their lives ended within 2.5 years, but not without fear. For well within that time, in 1919, Jacinta disclosed that Our Lady had told her that she would soon enter a Lisbon hospital where she would suffer much and die alone. The fulfillment of this frightening petition by the loving lady came in 1920. Nurburgring has written as well. The apparition predictions did not end with the forecasting of a frightening death of an innocent girl. On July 13, 1970, it openly looked ahead to October 13, 1970 to disarm its critics. In October, she predicted, I will perform a miracle so that all may believe. And when the large worshiping crowd had assembled on the meadow on that day, many of the 70,000 people reported seeing a solar phenomenon immediately after the Virgin's appearance. Martindale, in his message of the Fatima, quotes an account given by Garrett, a professor at the University of Columbia, which states, the sun, a few moments before, had pierced the thick clouds that held it hidden so that it shone clear and strongly. It looked like a burnished wheel cut out of a mother of pearl. The disc spun dizzily around. It swirled itself with mad rapidity. Then the sun, preserved celerity, celerity of its rotation, detached itself from the firmament and advanced blood-red toward the earth, threatening to crush us with the weight of its vast and fiery mass. During this occurrence, the three children proudly claimed Mary had given them three important messages which they carefully wrote down. But since Lucia's two young cousins died within a relatively short time after the first ghostly appearance, only she remained in possession of the messages. Every pope since that time has examined the Fatima messages for possible relevancy to his time, but none of them ever found a plausible connection. Now, this is the report in, on Fatima in the background of the facts. Now, in the keys of this blood, on page 626, here's what he says. Involved as chief factors in the whole Fatima event were three peasant children, a brother and a sister, Francisco and Jacinta Marto, 9 and 7 years old respectively, and their 10-year-old cousin, Lucia dos Santos. The brother and sister were illiterate. Lucia could barely read or write. They spent their days herding their family sheep. These three children claimed that on the 13th day of each month, beginning on May 13, 1917, Mary had appeared to them in a particular spot called Cova da Iria, in the neighborhood of their sheep pastures, that she told them that she had an important message for all the nations and all men and women, and that after coming to see them each 13th day of the coming months, on October 13th, she would, by the power of God, perform a miracle in order to substantiate the authenticity and vital importance of her message. By one means or another, news of the successive appearances spread throughout Portugal, Europe, and the two Americas. Hence the throngs of people gathered at Cova da Iria in Fatima at midday on October 13th. Not only the month and the day and the place were predicted by the children, the exact hour, midday, was foretold. What happened at the precise hour was a cameraman's dream. Even Cecil B. DeMille would not have fantasized.
DeMille
had fantasized.
He's a famous movie.
Okay. I didn't know that. That's okay. It had rained torrentially all the night on Friday, October 12th. On the morning of the 13th, the hamlet of Fatima was blanketed in driving rain beneath a cloud-bound sky. Now follow this. Everyone and everything was sodden. The dirt roads were quagmires of mud. They had a good 3 inches of water in Cova da Iria, where the three children were waiting with their families, surrounded by those thousands of visitors. Toward midday, the voice of Lucia, the eldest child, was heard saying, "Look up at the sun." All looked up. The rain suddenly stopped. The heavy veil of clouds broke asunder. The sun appeared. At the sight of that sun, uncontrollable waves of surprise, awe, fear, panic, joy swept through the crowds. The sun they now saw clearly was the same sun John Paul II later was to see in August of 1981. This was not the unbearable midday light sun normal in the skies of Portugal and Rome, the sun you cannot stare at without damaging your eyes. This sun was a fast-spinning plate of brightly shining silver, a giant pinwheel turning on its own axis, casting off beams of colored light, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet, that tinted faces, clothes, cars, carts, umbrellas, animals, ponds, grass, mountaintop, and horizon in all the successive hues of the rainbow. That was just the first part of what the onlookers described picturesquely as the dance of the sun. It lasted 2 or 3 minutes. The second part of the dance started with the cessation of the spinning motion. Now the sun roamed back and forth among the clouds, seeming to tremble and pulsate within itself, appearing and half disappearing behind puffs and strips of cloud, occasionally stopping and spinning again on its own axis and throwing off those brilliant shafts of multicolored light. The third part of that exotic dance came with the spinning, when the roaming stopped. That brilliant disc was stationary for a while, trembling, pulsating, rotating on its own. Then, without warning, it plunged from its position above the clouds, hurtling in zigzag fashion toward the earth and toward the upturned faces of those tens of thousands. One observer described later how the smiling look of wonder of the faces around them in that crowd changed first into looks of puzzlement, then immediately into white-faced fear, according to that solar disk, ever rotating and pulsating, came closer and closer, appearing bigger and bigger in its relenting descent, the heat increasing as it came nearer and nearer. as this molten mass of light and heat zigzagged downward, cries of anguish and horror, prayers and explanations rose up. It's the end of the world. We're all going to die. God, forgive me of my sins. And the like. You can just catch the picture. But in the middle of that downward plunge of that blazing sun, the voices of the three children were heard above the cries of anguish. Pray and pray hard. Everything's going to be all right. For a time, it did look as if that disc was going to smash into the crowds, crushing and burning all before it. At the peak of these fears and horror, the disc halted, reversed its path, ascended back to the sky. It stopped moving. The spinning ceased. There was no more colors thrown off. The people could no longer look at the midday sun. They noticed that there was no movement whatever in the branch of the tree. No sooner was it noted that the leaves and branches were motionless in the middle of strong winds than they noticed again, all together, that there was no water on the ground, no mud, all was dry and dusty. Then someone shouted up, "I'm dry, bone dry." The cry suddenly became universal. Everybody's clothes a few minutes before, heavy and gold with rainwater, was now dry and light and crisp and warm. The action at Fatima. And the present Pope had that vision repeated to him as he was recovering from the attack that was made on his life. And so he is a very devoted, very much of a devotee of the Fatima mystique, or the mysterious ghost-like one that came. This has not been given its relative importance, but it's having its effect on the papal policy and the papal actions at the present time. And this we need to understand. But notice the picture, the connection. The Virgin Mary connected with the what?
Sun.
The sun. And the sun connected with the sun god. And the sun god is?
The dragon.
The devil, the dragon, that fiery serpent, Peros Drakon. The whole issues are all fitting in and filling up. The whole thing is there. And you've got the documentation for it. And I could go on and read the various things that are involved here. He also tells about this papal reaction that in the first part of this, that the Pope saw this particular event, and he was assured, well, here's what the sentence is. What those on the spot witness saw and recorded in October in 1917 is what John Paul saw in the luminous skies of Latio above the seven hills of Rome in August of 1981. The sun above the seven hills of Rome. And that sun is whom? Well, so again you have a very...
There's a lot of other popes have looked into this vision of the Fatima.
The messages.
And they have studied it and put it aside because they figured it was not connected.
That's true. It says that in here. But this present Pope hasn't taken quite that attitude.
Right.
And he's working toward that particular end. And so we're going to need to discuss that as we come to the last half of the 20th century. All of these things, except what I brought you about our comments on Luke 21:24, all transpired in the first half of the 20th century. Now we come to the last half of the 20th century, and we're going to see the development and what's actually taking place in these things that have transpired. But remember also that the Catholic Church believes that the woman of Revelation 12, clothed in the sun, is the Virgin Mary. And here is their physical evidence of basis of their belief. Also, we need to understand that in 1950, right as the century breaks and comes to the next half, the dogma of the bodily assumption of Mary into heaven was promulgated. So we're dealing with raw spiritism under the guise of a religious garb. And what we're going to do as we study the next section on the last half of the 20th century, we're going to find that the Roman Catholic Church has changed its sign and its seal.